Well, we've been having a wonderful spring in Wisconsin, but one reminder of winter is all the potholes on our roads. Do you ever wonder what happens to your car when you hit one? Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller. Jim Ward is in the studio with me today. He is the service manager at Smart Motors and has over 10 years of master certification. He stops by a few times a year to help you out with your vehicle questions. And we're going to talk about the effect of potholes, also what to do when we see a flooded street and other spring-related topics. Jim will also take your vehicle questions. Do you have a problem with your car or truck? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Jim, it's so good to see you again.
It's great to be here, Jill.
I hear you're very busy this time of year. You're starting your busy season.
We are. It's taking off, and some of that is pothole repair and suspension repair from some of the delightful roads that we have.
Yeah, I know. We try to avoid them, but we're going to hit them, right?
You are. You know, there's only so much you can do preventatively. I mean, you know, one of the first tips anybody will give you is keep your spacing greater, you know. Drive around Madison sometime and try to keep your spacing greater. Someone's going to pull in there
on
you. You know, but some of the things you can watch out for, you know, if we all do this anyway, but if you see the cars ahead of you swerving suddenly and moving around, you know, it's time to hyper alert, pay attention, and kind of if they're going to the left, you're probably going to need to as well and try to avoid that pothole.
So what does it do to our cars when we hit those potholes?
Well, you know, it depends. And honestly, most of the time, it doesn't do anything. Cars are designed to go over bumps. They're designed to take a lot of that into account. So often nothing at all happens. But one car can hit a bump in just a certain way and have nothing happen to it, and another car hit that bump and have damage occur. The most common damage that's going to occur is going to be to a tire or to the alignment of the car. Fortunately, the steering and suspension knuckles and linkages that take the jar and the shock have some adjustments to allow for being able to take that, rather than something get bent, it gets pushed out a little bit, and usually some adjustments can be done to correct that without necessarily always having to replace components. So those things can be done. Part of what will occur also depends on the time of year it is. We have potholes in the dead of winter when it's absolutely freezing out.
Yeah.
And in those circumstances, suspensions and the whole car is much stiffer. And the suspension system in a car, your shock absorbers or struts, have usually they're going to be an oil-filled shock with a seal on it. That seal is going to be very brittle. That whole assembly is very vulnerable in that weather anyway. So you can have a seal for a shock fail. That's not going to be a quick instantaneous failure, like where you're stranded along the side of the road, but slowly the oil will seep out of that shock, and pretty soon when your car goes over even a normal bump, it kind of is like jello for the next half of a block. And so, you know, that can be an indication that something has happened in the past. But a tire blowout or having a bulge in the sidewall of a tire or something can occur, and then that tire is if it gets a bulge in the sidewall, it's vulnerable to blowing out in a hard corner sometimes. So if you do hit a big bump, you want to have the car inspected as quickly as possible afterwards. And if you have a steering shimmy, or if the steering pulls one way or another, or the steering is off center, that's a good indication that there's an entire alignment problem that has occurred.
Okay, well, good tips on that. Now, another thing that we can run into, well, you know, most of the year, but spring especially, is water on the road. What should we be thinking when we see that?
Well, there's really two completely different situations here. I mean, we get rain and we drive around and there's puddles all the time.
Right.
But if you come to a place where you normally can cross the road and there's a little stream or trickle that looks pretty high, there's temptations to cross it. In fact, if I Googled this a little bit just to see what the latest was, and so often you'll see someone who writes something and start, well, we all know we shouldn't do this. Here's the best way to go about it if you're going to do it.
Oh.
You know, don't. Do it. Just don't do it. The National Weather Service has got a phrase that they'll let anybody use, so y'all are going to use it on the air. It's turn around and don't drown. That's what it's called, because it only takes 6 inches of water to sweep, you know, a small car off the road, and you don't know, you know, you may come to a small bridge. Do you really know if the bridge is even still under there? Was the water flow much higher earlier and washed out? Some things that can happen when water levels are very high, if you're in an urban area, manhole covers can get pushed up and out of their place. And I mean, if you hit that hole, then obviously that's even worse. So, but particularly when it's flowing water that's going across the road, I can't say that there's a safe way to cross that. People do it all the time. You'll see it. But, you know, that it's a common cause of drownings. It's a dangerous situation. And that's clearly not what you're usually going to run into. But if you do run into that situation, you know, don't be brave. Don't feel like you got to get there on time. Be smart and go around it. Now, if you're talking about a city street that you can predictably see, I can see the curbs. This is a few inches of water. There are a lot of things that can go wrong. And again, most of the time, you're going to watch most of the cars ahead of you, and they'll go right through and seemingly have no problem. But part of it is a variable on tires. Tires have treads, and the depth of that tread is designed to displace water so that the tire obviously stays in contact with the road. If you have a pretty slick tire, it's going to get pushed up on top of that water and hydroplane. And when you're skiing, it's kind of hard to steer. So you can lose control of the car that way. There's also the danger anytime you go into water. Every year, and last year was a spectacular year for water events and lots of rain, and so we had lots of these last year. A big rain event will occur, and we'll have cars towed in that have sucked up a little bit of water into the intake of the engine, and water doesn't compress like air and gas, and that does significant engine damage. And again, you could watch five cars go through that same puddle ahead of you. Somewhat of element of luck, bad luck, I suppose, but it doesn't take much more than a teaspoon or two of water. The air intake of car's engine is usually up on a lot of cars. It's up by the driver's headlight area. And ultimately, if you ever were to put your hand in front of that when the car is running, it's like a vacuum cleaner. I mean, there's a suction there, and it's a pretty strong suction. So if a big splash of water comes up, you know, some of it's going to be stopped by your air filter, but an air filter is not like a 4-micron, you know, filter. It's got to be able to let flow through it, airflow through it. So water can and does get through, and someone ends up being the unlucky one that ends up having to replace a motor. And you know, that's not the kind of event that warranties will cover. Your insurance might get involved. But this is tricky, too, with insurance coverage. There's been changes in the laws. So, again, if we go back to potholes or water damage, anything on the road, the most common thing is often just a tire problem. But and you may have to get an alignment. But further damage can occur. And at one time, you could claim those to municipalities and counties and the state, but the laws have changed, and you really that's just considered a hazard of the road, and it's not really something you can claim. Insurance companies really won't entertain most often a claim for a tire in that situation or an alignment, but if you get greater suspension damage or even a wheel damage, often your insurance company will step up then. But it's got to be beyond the limit of an alignment and tire, usually, for an insurance company to get involved. So, you know, avoiding these things is best, but if you get in those situations, it's a little tricky to navigate getting help to pay for it. A new car generally does not come with any coverage for tires. When you buy tires, they're always going to offer you road hazard coverage, and that road hazard coverage means if something happens to that tire outside of a warranty defect, like hitting a pothole and damaging it, then you'd have coverage. So it's something to consider. It's offered when you buy a car. It's usually offered when you buy tires. You know, you can take your chances, and some people do. And in fact, I often don't buy extended warranties on anything because I'll tinker and take them apart and figure I have an advantage. And I advised my son the same thing. He didn't listen to me, and he's had four incidents in the last year where his policy paid for itself spectacularly. So listen to him.
Get that insurance. Listen to your son. Don't do as I do. Do as I say, right? Or the other way around. Our guest today is Jim Ward. He is the service manager at Smart Motors, and he has over 10 years of master certification and has worked professionally with vehicles since 1978. What questions do you have for him? We've got a couple of lines open, so give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. And we're going to go right over to the phones. Our first caller is Mark in Mineral Point. Hi, Mark. What question do you have for Jim?
Yeah, hi. Well, actually, I have two, but the first one is kind of a general question about getting suspension work done. Just when, you know, your suspension is, you can tell it's pretty worn out, you know, it's not firm and quiet, it's, you know, getting kind of noisy. And I guess one question is it more important to have your front suspension really in, you know, a good shape than the rear? I know ideally you want to get all of it replaced at once, but and I guess I'm just wondering if lots of times what's causing the problems is the strut mounts are coming loose. And then I have another question for you.
Well, in terms of front or rear suspension, if you repair one and the other one's weak, and either way you're going to have some compromised handling, and you know, in normal situations where everything's going where traffic is going fine and you don't have to do any sudden evasive kind of maneuvers, you know, it probably doesn't present a handling problem. But if the front end or the rear end is weak on a car and the other end has just been repaired, any kind of sudden maneuver that you have to do, you're going to have compromised handling and a compromised recovery and response in the car. So, you know, generally people are more concerned about the front end of the car. It's what leads. But, you know, I wouldn't say that, and if you had to pick, you know, sometimes it's budgeting is such that you just can't. It really depends on the severity. It's not typical that both ends are in the same condition at the same time. Strut mounts are a bearing in a device that does wear out. It's up at the top of the suspension. Assuming that the tire is a big part of the suspension. Most people underestimate the difference that a tire can make in how a car rides and how it feels and handles over bumps. It's pretty significant. I would say as much as your shocks, struts, and springs, really. But as those things get compromised, if you have a fairly stiff tire and if you have a fairly stiff suspension, a lot of shock gets transferred all the way to the top, and that's where that bearing is. It can start to develop some play. It usually is not an issue. I can't say I've seen that as an assembly that comes apart very often and just falls apart driving down the road, but if you ignore that rattle on those bumps long enough, it can start to elongate the holes that they're mounted in and can do more damage. So you don't want to ignore something like that, you know, for a long, long time. If you first start hearing it, it probably isn't that severe, but I definitely get any kind of suspension noise checked out rather than presume it's a strut mount, but strut mounts are fairly common.
And what was your other question, Mark?
Okay, this one is kind of a sort of a repair shop question. I have one of my cars in the shop, and they are trying to diagnose it, but they took it for a test drive, and I just found out that the hood blew off and damaged the hood and cracked the windshield. Now, I've put, you know, over 150,000 miles on this car, and I've never had that happen. And I'm, you know, I don't know if somebody had opened the hood. I was pretty sure it was shut when they got the car. And, you know, it was locked down. And I don't know if they were driving super fast even to have a possibility of that happening. But, I mean, I don't know. I kind of think that they should put the bill for fixing it.
You know, and certainly any consumer is going to have that perspective. And generally I would, too. There are some things you know, and I've been doing this almost 40 years. I've been in that scenario a couple of times. You know, one of the things that'll happen is that the hood latch on a car can get rusty and it can get sticky. And ultimately, you may notice that and realize it yourself. I don't know if you had or had not, but you may notice that it's harder to pull the cable, or when you go to shut it, you have to shut it a couple of times or slam it. Beyond that, there's also a safety latch, which should be your secondary backup. The latch itself, if it doesn't latch for some reason, there's a little hook. But if the hood latch got rusty, the safety latch tends to get rusty too. It's got a spring on it that should automatically pull it over. And if it doesn't do that, you know, I would have a hard time saying that a technician who didn't see that was incompetent. Of course, we would all hope that they would see it, but it's not a super common scenario, but it does happen from time to time, and it doesn't take much speed. If the hood isn't latched and the safety latch isn't there, you're not going to get to 30 miles an hour before your hood and your windshield are going to meet. There's just too much force pushing it up. So, you know, I don't know enough about the circumstances there. You know, if it happened on their watch when they had the car as a shop, it's hard not to accept the liability for something like that. You know, it just is what it is, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the given technician is incompetent. It, you know, it's just something that you don't expect to happen. You don't expect, and it's not a common thing to look for. There really aren't many maintenance guides where part of the maintenance that you do on a car is to visually inspect that latch. But I can tell you, any technician that had that experience, it became part of his personal list.
I bet it would. Well, good luck with that, Mark. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Ron in Wallace, Michigan. Hi, Ron. What question do you have for us?
Good morning. I have a 2003 Silverado, and when I turn the steering wheel to make a turn, I hear a clunk, 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 clunk. It sounds like it's coming from the steering column.
Mm-hmm.
And either way I turn, left or right, I hear that clunk, clunk, clunk. But once I'm going down straight down the road, the little corrections I make or driving on the highway, I don't hear anything. It's just when I make maybe a 90-degree turn either way, I hear a clunk, clunk, clunk. And I don't know. I have a safety concern. I mean, that if I'm worried about losing my steering.
And
something in my steering system, yep, that's making that noise, and I don't want to end up in the other lane of the highway.
That's an admirable goal.
Yes.
And any time you have clunk in the steering or suspension, it is something that should be investigated. That sound, most often, in my experience, is going to turn out to be related to what's called a flex joint or a universal joint that's in the steering column. Generally, the steering shafts that go from your steering wheel to the steering gearbox or steering rack, the mechanism that is affecting on the other end, is not a straight line. They have a bend in them somewhere, and when you have a bend in a shaft that has to turn, you have something called a universal joint or a flex joint in there, and those have a tendency to get a stiff spot in them, and ultimately, sometimes they can be lubricated. I've seen certain manufacturers that have procedures to take a little type of it's almost like an injection needle and put a special grease in there to lubricate it. But if it's, you know, there's a certain amount of play that's acceptable in that joint, and there's a certain amount that's excessive. And if it's become excessive, the joint, which is usually part of one of the steering shafts, there's usually a couple of shafts, a main one and a sub-assembly. The part that has that joint as part of it is probably going to have to be replaced. But you definitely want to have it checked out, have it narrowed down. I mean, there are mount bolts for the whole steering column. The noise, although it sounds like it's from inside the car in the steering column, and you're probably right, you sure want to make sure that it's not out at the actual steering gear, the tie rods, and the links and linkages for your steering. So I would have it investigated, but I think you're going to end find out that it's a flex joint for the steering column.
Okay, thanks for the question, Ron. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We've been talking with Jim Ward. He's the service manager at Smart Motors. Do you have a question for him? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Well, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll take a look at native plants of the Midwest with the author of a new comprehensive guide. Hope you can join us at 11 tomorrow or 7 on Saturday in the morning or online anytime. But right now we are talking about cars, and we're going to go right back to the phones. We have Wendy in Appleton calling. Hi, Wendy. What can we help you with?
Good morning. You can help me with my old 1998 Toyota Corolla, which has been reliable as Toyotas are, but I have something that happens maybe twice a year or so, and I'm kind of worried about it. It's when I start the car, and I turn the key, and it cranks as usual. It's like something will happen, like something will catch in my wrist, or I just don't quite hang on to the key long enough, and it doesn't start. And at that point, it appears to be flooded. And the last time this happened, both my husband and I tried holding the pedal to the floor and cranking on the key, and it simply does not start. And we even left it overnight with the hood up, hoping things would evaporate. And the next morning, I still had trouble getting it started. I finally did after cranking on it for about 5 minutes. So I'm just wondering what's going on, and is this something that someone can fix? Or do I just need to watch and be more careful about how I start it?
I don't think it's probably your technique of starting it. You probably had this car for a while, and I'm pretty sure you know how to start it. So there's something going on there from time to time. When it doesn't start, and I just want to make sure we're on the same page on what we think is occurring here. You say you crank it, and I just want to make sure, because often we say this. What I understand is cranking is a turn the key, and I'm hearing rrr, 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 rrr. The engine's turning over and making that sound, but it's not firing. It doesn't do any of that, and you just get this continued cranking. Rrr, 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 rrr. And that's what you're experiencing, Wendy?
Yes, and that is after that initial, oops, I let go of the key.
Okay, and if you keep trying...
I catch on my wrist sometimes it seems like it almost starts, and then it didn't quite catch, and then I try it again, and yes, I get exactly what you're describing.
Well, you know, there are different things that can happen with fuel systems. When it does start, how does it run just like it always does, or is it a rough idle and a rough running when it does initially start, when it finally starts?
Like this time the next morning when we tried it, it took a lot of cranking finally to get it started, and it almost didn't start again. So it's very rough initially, and I'm kind of working the pedal a little bit, trying to find out exactly where I should have the pedal to keep it running?
Well, and this could very well be a matter of too much or not enough fuel. That's an injection system that when you are initially cold starting the car, any car needs a richer fuel mixture, and that injection system, when you first turn the key, there was an issue with those, that if you didn't crank it long enough and allow it to keep going, that rich mixture didn't get fired and it could flood and follow the plug. And that may be what's happening, and it takes a while. I mean, ultimately, someone that was able to get it to act up could pull the plug and see if that's what's going on. And there is something to be said for the timing. If you, particularly in really cold weather, you may have difficulty starting if you don't crank it long enough, because that cycle starts all over again. It's supposed to be really rich right off the bat, and then it's supposed to back off a little bit from that. And if you don't get that long crank cycle on the first turn, it can become problematic. They change a lot of cars in vehicles to have what's called auto start, where you may not even realize that your car has this. You turn the key, and whether you did or did not continue to hold the key, a computer takes over and continues to crank it for you. So manufacturers that had problems with the systems that I think might be affecting your symptoms went to some of those, including Toyota, went to some of those auto crank systems so that it would just automatically do that if the temperature was low enough and you were trying to start it. So it may be a matter. I mean, if someone were able to pull a spark plug when it doesn't start and look at the plugs, if the plugs are really wet and gooey looking, fouled, that's likely what's going on. It is possible too that some of the controls, some of the air controls, the air and fuel is mixed and controlled by a number of different devices. I think that car uses an idle air control valve that can be sticky, but I would expect that to give you problems more consistently. It seems like you're kind of cued into cranking that key, and that is something I'm familiar with. That can be an issue. And they're just, once it's flooded, you can hold the gas pedal all the way to the floor. And when you're cranking it, by the way, you don't really want to crank it more than about 15 seconds at a time. Let it off, let it recover. You can heat up some circuits and do some damage to your starting circuits and ignition circuits if you hold that key cranking too long. And it may help to push the gas pedal to the floor, open that throttle. It may let some more air into that system to air it out. But generally, an engine that's flooded is probably going to have to set a few hours before it's going to clear out enough to be able to start. And so, yep, I would just try to be real cognizant of turning the key. But you could likely take it somewhere, leave it overnight, have them, if they could duplicate it, or if sometime that it's done it, somebody pulls the plugs out, they're probably going to be able to confirm if the plugs are real damp and fouled looking. That's likely what's going on.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, Wendy. John in Duluth emailed us. He has a small coolant leak, and he knows it's not good for the environment, but the cost of repair is high. So as long as he keeps up on the coolant level by adding more as needed, is there any damage to his car and anything else that he can do to remedy the situation that might be more affordable than a complete repair?
Oh, boy, I'm about to go down one of those roads of you might want to try this, but I would never try it. There, one of the most common things people do in a situation like this is to buy a product called Stop Leak. There are different brands, and you can pour it in the radiator and heat the car up, but those can cause as many problems as they can fix a coolant leak. They can fix a small coolant leak at least temporarily, but they can also plug up your heater core, that because the heater in your car uses that same coolant and it goes through a small little radiator that's in your dash, and it's got finer passages than the radiator and engine. And so you want to be really careful about that. By the way, all cars seep some coolant. Most water pumps have a seep hole on them so that at certain temperatures and under certain conditions, a little bit of coolant can weep out rather than create a pressure situation inside that cooling system. It's a bypass, and it's not like they lose a lot. Some manufacturers that I've worked with over the years had experienced customers complaining about seeing these drips, and they redesigned their water pump to have a small little, about the size of the palm of your hand, a little pan built into the underside of the weep hole of the water pump that gets hot enough that liquid just evaporates and you end up with just the crusty stuff that's left. Antifreeze, however, is really bad for the environment. It's really bad for animals and anything else. So if you've got a coolant leak, in particular, it's bad, you don't want something like that leaving puddles where animals and stuff can come along and get into it. And depending, where this coolant leak is can also determine how serious it is. I mean, if it's a head gasket of an engine, you can have corrosion issues. Antifreeze is not friendly to all surfaces, so it can cause some other problems. So, you know, it is hard when you get older cars and they have expensive repairs that need to be done. And there are probably shortcuts and workarounds that you could use, but they can end up costing you more money. They're not as good for the environment. And you may be doing damage long term, depending on where this leak is and where else that coolant might be going. So, you know, I would encourage you to look around for, you know, different options, get a few different estimates and see, you know, if you know what needs to be done, if there are, you know, there may be a small little independent shop that would repair it much cheaper than the estimates you've been given so far.
Okay, John, hope you can find someone to help you with that one. Let's go back to the phones. We have Carrie on the line from La Crosse. Hi, Carrie. What's your question?
Hi. Well, I have another comment then after about one of the other callers' questions. But my question right now is I have a 1999 Oldsmobile 88, and when I'm driving down the interstate, when I get above 60, my steering and my car starts to shake. And I didn't know if that was a tie rod going bad or if that was maybe I need to get some new front tires. So I didn't know if maybe they were just off balance, and with the condition of the tires, they have a lower tread. If maybe it's the tires that are causing it to shake when I get to a certain speed, or if it's maybe tie rod or something else with the suspension that's causing that.
Well, tire balance is the most common thing that we would see for that symptom. Any worn steering or suspension components in the front end could cause that, but yeah, a tire getting out of balance will give you a shake, and it'll be a shake at a very specific speed range. And as tires wear out, that balance does change over time, and it's also possible if you hit one of those notorious potholes, you might not have done, you know, extensive damage, but tires are not truly round, and they're not truly... they don't weigh the same on one half as they do on the other. So when you put one on a wheel, the whole concept of tire balancing is that you're countering that weight. One side of the tire might weigh a quarter ounce more than the other side, and a computerized wheel balancer tells you exactly where to put that quarter ounce of weight on the other side of the wheel to counter that. So if one of those weights falls off or gets shifted, that throws off the balance, and that's by far the most common cause of that. You know, when you take a car in to have any kind of a service done, a tire rotation, oil change, anymore, almost every shop will do what's called a multi-point inspection. Usually these are courtesy inspections, and part of that usually is checking those steering and suspension knuckles and linkages. If you're having a specific problem, though, and you ask somebody to check that problem, there may be an inspection charge specifically for that. But one of the simplest things I would try is your situation. If you rotate the tires and the shake suddenly isn't in the steering anymore, and you feel it more in your seat, then you've just transferred those misbalanced tires to the rear end, and that's sometimes the cheapest, easiest way to determine if it's tires, because it'll shift where the shake is.
And did you have a comment, Carrie, you said?
I did. So the woman who was having an issue with the car starting, started having my car ride a little bit rough, and I thought it might have been a spark plug because I had a different spark plug changed a few months prior, and it started feeling the same way. And then when I would go to start it, it was having some issues starting. And it turns out my valve spring was going, and then eventually my valve spring fully broke. One of the valve springs fully broke, and then it wouldn't start at all. But it turned out that the issue I was having with my car starting to ride rough and not being able to start right away and stuff and taking a little bit to start and having to press the gas down to get it to start was that the valve spring started going, and then it eventually entirely broke, and then the car wouldn't start at that point. So I didn't know if that could have also been an issue for her.
Well, that isn't a very common problem on it's a different type of engine. It's got a different type of valve drivetrain. So, I can't say I've seen that much on that engine. And once that happens, it's not intermittent. Her condition is intermittent. It comes and goes with your valve spring. When it first starts going, because it's not getting the right fuel mixture, spark plugs do start to foul. And that they probably did find fouled spark plugs that were a pretty direct result of a weak or broken valve spring. So those are likely related symptoms. They're going to go as least invasive as they can initially, which would be looking at those plugs. But if the plugs continue to get fouled, then they go deeper and eventually find that valve spring. But as you know, once a valve spring broke, it's not starting and running anymore. So yeah, it didn't really fit the symptoms that she has.
Okay, well, thank you though, Carrie. We appreciate that. Let's go to Dan in Mercer. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thanks to Jim for volunteering his time on this. I'm actually a retired mechanic. I went to MATC in the early 70s. I was a NISE certified in the very beginning when they came out with that. And one thing I'd like to say is that kudos to people that are mechanics, or what they're referred to as tech technicians, versus the other trades in industry, electricians, plumbers, carpenters, auto mechanics changes constantly, even from one model to another. And what they have to keep up with is really admirable. Especially, I mean, people get frustrated with the medical profession, but the human body hasn't changed at all like cars do. I have a specific question for Jim. I have two 2005 Toyota Matrixes. The first one I bought a number of years ago was 71,000 miles on it. It now has 137,000. I just bought my second one over the internet, and I'm not sure I'll ever do it again, sight unseen. And when I got it, it's another 2005. It's an exact clone of the Matrix I had before, or still have, and it also has 71,000 miles on it. Both of these, Jim, are five-speed manual transmissions. And the new one that I just got last month over the internet has a ticking noise when it's in reverse and when it's under a load in reverse. If I push the clutch in and let it coast in reverse, that noise goes away. Do you have any clues for me other than pulling the transaxle and having to tear it apart? And are there parts available for the internal workings on that?
There are definitely parts available. You seem to believe that the noise is coming from the transmission. I mean, there's...
Yeah, I don't feel that it's a CV joint.
And you're... Yep, it'll do it in a straight line. So, yep, not likely to be a CV joint. What's the frequency of the ticking that you hear when
you're
moving? It
would be like this. It'd be a tick, 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 tick.
You know, Dan, I can't tell you off the top of my head. It's ultimately... probably never going to do it on a lift, so because you're not going to be able to create the load condition. You know, ultimately, these are the mysteries that we use a little device called chassis ears for. You know, because you might be right; it might be coming from the transmission, but the initial thing that you really want to do is confirm or find that that's not the case. And so, some chassis ears, put in some different parts of the car, different areas of the transmission, near the axle flanges, up on the bell housing, that would be closer to where the clutch and flywheel meet, would be some things I would want to be trying to do with that to try to get a better idea of precisely where the sound is coming from.
So what was that once more, Jim, please?
The device is called chassis ears. I mean, it's a tool that essentially is just a set of alligator clips that have like a microphone device on them, and sometimes they're wired and sometimes they're wireless, and you'll have about five or six clips that come in a kit, and you clip them on different parts of the car, and you have a little box you take in the car with you. If it's wired, you have to almost put the car, either crawl into the car and put it on a lift, and you take tie wraps and kind of secure the wires, or a lot of times the wires come with little Velcro straps that you can secure them to some other components under the car. Obviously, you want to keep them clear of steering and suspension, not because of the things that move the axles, but essentially it's a listening device, and then you have a box in the car with you with a little headphone, and you can switch channels from one of those clips to the other, and as you drive the car, you try this clip and you try that clip. They're color-coded. You keep in mind where they're at, and you just make some notes on. So you narrow down where the noise is really coming from. If it's an internal transmission noise, it's going to have to come out to take a look and see what might be going on there, but 05 Matrix is definitely a vehicle that parts are still readily available for, so I wouldn't worry about that. That's certainly not getting too old to be able to get parts and fix it.
Okay, Dan, well, good luck with that one. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Phil in Peterson, Minnesota. Hi, Phil.
How are you doing today?
Well, what's your question?
Well, Jim, thanks for all your advice you're giving to everybody, and I need some advice this morning.
Sure.
I've got a 2016 Volkswagen Jetta that I had to have be towed out of a snowbank the end of last July, and it was one of those seasons where we here in Minnesota you couldn't tell where the road is and where the snow was stopped. So it's typical. Anyway, I called to get a tow, and the gentleman that came to pick me up and to tow me, for some reason, put a chain on the rear of my axle, and I expected him with his tow truck to winch me out, typical. Well, he jerked me twice, and I felt like I was in an automobile accident when he did this, and I thought, what the heck? So we got things squared away, and we got the road plowed out and what have you. Well, come the middle of March, I noticed that I was having a low tire on the right rear of my vehicle. So I checked it, and pressure was down. I thought, this is kind of strange. So I was going to go down to the tire repair shop to have it checked for a leak. Well, I didn't get very far, and I had to change to my spare. When I got down to the shop, we looked at this tire, and if you face the rear of the car facing forward, the inside edge of that right rear tire was worn down through the cord. That's why it leaked. It then went flat.
Sure.
So we put our used tire on temporarily, and within a week, I had to do the same thing to the left rear, same situation. So I took it to the dealer to get this examined, and once I had tires that would hold air, and there was severe damage to where both the rear control arms need to be replaced, and there's a subframe assembly that was damaged that needs to be replaced. Now, here's the question I have for you. Of course, the insurance company wants to do the song and dance of, well, we've got a used one that came out of another vehicle, you know, that we can put in. And this is, you know, this car has like 20,000 miles on it. And what my concern is, in my experience in the past, is when you start using substandard parts, that something that's this critical with the subassembly where these control arms and basically the rear suspension all attaches to this,
yeah,
I'm contesting this with the insurance company and say, look, in 28 years of being insured by you people, I've had one windshield claim, you know,
and
I'm not satisfied with this. So the agency has taken pictures of the damage and sent that to the claims department, but of course they're looking at their profits are more important than the safety of the customer.
What do you think about that, Jim?
Well, that there is always a concern of using used parts when repairing cars, and in fact, different states have different laws, but Wisconsin has specific laws about suspension parts that may be or may not be replaced with used parts after a repair like that. You know, it recovering a car from going in the ditch or any kind of situation when you get stuck like that is kind of an art, and you know, things can go wrong, and clearly things went wrong. It sounds like a pull strap got put onto the wrong component and pulled things way out of alignment, and that's obviously what caused your tire wear. But in terms of the liability, you know, part of this, you're looking at your own auto insurance. You know, I would be wondering about the tow service that came out. They have insurance as well, and they kind of created this situation. I don't know if your insurance company is aware of that, but they may get in touch with the other company's insurance company to look at this. But I would be concerned about used parts being put on. And again, I don't know the laws in the state of Minnesota as well. Usually the components that they restrict are components that have like a ball and socket knuckle in them, like a tie rod or a ball joint or something like that. These more solid parts, they often will say are okay on the list, but you own the car and you should be able to have an influence on the kind of parts that are used, whether they're original factory parts or aftermarket parts, and whether they're new or used parts. A 16 Jetta is a new enough car that really should be repaired with new parts. You know, I would agree with you. I don't think that should be compromised. I don't know necessarily with those components that they're even pushing the law in Wisconsin, but I would push back on that. Again, you're a long-term customer with them. You know, that is a repair that I would prefer to see done with new parts.
Okay, well, good luck, Phil. Thank you for the call. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking with Jim Ward. He's the service manager at Smart Motors. Do you have a question for him? Give us a call. We have a phone line open. The number is 1-800-642-1234, and you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Coming up at 2 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn talks to the author of a new children's book about the life and times of Grammy-winning folk musician Pete Seeger. That's at 2 o'clock on the Ideas Network. And right now we are talking about cars and vehicle maintenance with our guest Jim Ward. Now, Jim, we want to talk a little bit about hybrid cars, and they're becoming, well, more and more plentiful. Is there anything new that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, there in the Toyota world, there certainly is new news in, on the hybrid front. The Prius used to be a model, a single model, and now the Prius has become a family line of cars for Toyota, and there are hybrids of various sizes and hybrids that are gas and electric, and hybrids that are plug-in that are primarily electric, and they have a new model called the Prius Prime, which is kind of like the best of both worlds. That it can drive. You could buy it and drive it like the Prius 4, technically, and never plug it in. But it's got some, as the technology rolls along, more and more hybrids have some features that are pretty interesting. And a lot of it just has to do with energy control. The systems that control how the hybrid and the gas systems work together, Toyota calls theirs a synergy system. And those are really highly artificial intelligence systems that manage a number of different components. But when it comes to the plug-in cars, they have programming that you can do right on your dashboard to have the car look for when the most economical time to charge it is. So it'll turn on and start charging when the rates are the lowest for you. They have charge modes now where you can put it in a charge mode when you're driving on the highway. That might cost you a mile or two to the gallon, but it will help it accumulate the miles that it can go on electric. So if you have to drive 60 miles between a couple of cities, you could gain, the Prime. I believe it's advertised to have 22 miles on all electric in the city. And so you could be driving on the highway and put it in a charge mode. And again, you might lose a mile or two to the gallon. But by the time you get to the city you're going to, you could have gained your full electric mileage, drive around that city on strictly electric mode. And then when you're on your way back home, you can do it again. And when you get back into your home city, you do your city commuting then in electric mode.
Is that similar to how a hybrid works, where sometimes it's the gas and sometimes it's electric, the battery? And
well, they can go back and forth. I mean, some of the characteristics of hybrids are that you may, when you start, if you're not familiar with them, it can seem very unusual in to get in a car and start it and have no sound, nothing whatsoever.
I have a hybrid, and the first time it came to a stop at a stop, and it just died. I thought it died, and it didn't. Yep. So.
and actually, that technology has been around for a long time, and there are a lot of utility vehicles that aren't hybrid at all, and that are just designed to shut off and restart at stops just for fuel savings alone. But hybrids will do that very typically, and they'll go back and forth between electric and hybrid mode. And again, these systems have simply gotten more sophisticated and better at doing it. On the early hybrids, you could feel it. They were more noisy. They have certain sounds. You have regenerative braking that has got a very different sound when you're slowing down. And these are all great systems. As the cars get more sophisticated, there are less of these differences. You don't hear those sounds as much. The going in and out of hybrid modes isn't as noticeable. Regenerative braking's got some characteristics that it can be disconcerting. If you're using most of the time when you drive a hybrid, 95% of the time you hit the brake pedal, it's going to be the electric motors turning into generators running backwards and creating a load. It's not the regular conventional brakes that other cars have that are doing most of the stopping. Those conventional brakes will kick in at about the last minute just before a full stop. But if you hit a bump during that last few feet, if you hit a pothole during those last few feet, you may get this momentary feeling that it quit braking or that it accelerated, and it's just the characteristic of it suddenly switching over from the regenerative hybrid braking to the conventional braking. There was a moment there where it didn't get the input it needed, and again, there's just some characteristics different vehicles have that takes some getting used to. But as these hybrids get more sophisticated with all makes of them, they have less of those kind of symptoms. So if you've driven a hybrid maybe 5-10 years ago and thought, this isn't for me, you may want to try another one. Just rent one or take it out for a test drive somewhere and see. It's far closer to conventional cars now, and they have gotten better. The Prius Prime has got both drive motors, different axles, and it's a just in general. John Dolan is our hybrid expert, and he had to have a Prius Prime when they came out. We probably have sold 50 of them, and he has given me some examples of it was a case where they really underpromised and over-delivered on his charging. Although they claim 22. He has charged it and showed me a couple of pictures of it where the charge value he had after about 5 weeks of driving, he could get it to charge up to 32 miles of electric driving. So they all manufacturers are getting a little bit smarter about the under promise, over deliver. They're going to tell you that, but for the most part, EPA numbers have generally been set by the government, not the car makers, so they don't have a lot of say in a lot of that. But it's the best of both worlds when you can have a plug-in electric, particularly if you drive in town. And again, there are lots of different ones out there to compare to. I can't say I'm not biased about the Prius Prime.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phones. Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Irene in Phillips. Hi, Irene. What's your question?
Hi there, Joe and Jim. I have a 2011 Subaru Outback. It has almost 100,000 miles on it. My concern is, where is the timing belt, and should I take it to the dealer for a 1,000-mile checkup? I usually have a local mechanic do the basics on it.
You know, no matter where you get it serviced, one thing that's important to take a look at is what the manufacturer's recommendations are for 100,000 miles, because although we'd like to think that anywhere you go, including dealers, would all be the same, they'd be the same list, manufacturers don't require that dealers do that they use a specific list. They may recommend other things, and some of them may be legitimate recommendations beyond the manufacturers. They may be things that they've learned from experience, but by and large, the greatest thing I've learned over the years is that the manufacturer's recommendations are usually right on the money, and you usually don't need to do more than that. You don't usually need to do extra fluid flushes if you don't tow. No matter where you go, I would pull out that maintenance manual, take a look and see exactly what they say is supposed to be done in the car at that mileage, and then get a menu from the place that you have a service and see if they match. Because it's a very common thing to add a few extra services, a few other fluid flushes, but it's generally unnecessary. And unless they can give you a specific reason, if they aren't things that are on that list, they don't need to be done just because you're at that mileage. Timing belt, timing chain, and a given model, I believe, and I'm not certain about the application, I believe Subaru would use a chain in that car, but if it's got a timing belt, you definitely want to replace it at the interval that's recommended. And I can't say that I know that interval right off the top of my head. But again, the maintenance guide is the absolute guide of what you need to do. You do not need to do more than that unless you're having special circumstances and symptoms. So I would get that out. And again, whether you go to a Subaru or whether you go to an independent mechanic that you know and trust, I'd still check that list, just to make sure that you're A, doing everything that should be done and not doing extras.
Okay, that manual's there for a reason. Thank you for the call, Irene. Let's go to Aaron in Sun Prairie. Hi, Aaron.
Good afternoon. Question, while doing research to resolve a problem with my 2000 Toyota Tundra, found that the water was coming inside, and my research indicates that it might well be a design failure with the air box where fresh air comes in, and if that the drain is not large enough when heavy rain or, say, a car wash, when a lot of water enters it, it actually can back up and come in to the cabin of the vehicle. While doing his research, I found a number of other TSB or Toyota service bulletins that I wasn't aware of. I'm wondering, are those things that I should be actively taking into a dealer or a mechanic, or is it really more waiting for a recall if it's something that's more of a safety issue? One may not know that there are all these TSBs out there.
Sure, and this is a good question, a good subject and topic to talk about. For back a few years ago, we actually had paper manuals for things, and it's all electronic now, and so what I'm about to say is lost a little bit in time, but for any given year model of vehicle that comes out, in the next year or two after that vehicle's out, the manufacturer will have a number of different updates on various systems in the car, and it's not unusual at all that in a two-year period that would be as thick as a small-town phone book, which you might have a problem picturing anymore since I don't see phone books around much. But there are a lot of updates that come out, and there's a great variance to what vehicles they may apply to, because you can imagine a given vehicle is made from parts. One given component in a 2000 Tundra might be made by six different companies. One of those companies may have had an issue, so it might be a very specific production range that has a given issue. And most often, it's symptom-based. Not every vehicle may experience a given condition. Service bulletins like that are not something that a manufacturer really notifies anyone about. The dealers get it, but the consumers don't get a notice about a service bulletin. The manufacturer publishes those out to the dealers. If you come in with certain symptoms, those are the bulletins are what they go to. Recalls, special service campaigns, customer support programs, warranty enhancement programs are a number of things that generally manufacturers do notify customers about, and they all have different parameters. Some of them are strictly for safety, emission and safety related things, usually going to be mandated by the government, but more and more manufacturers will voluntarily come out with these other programs, and they'll call them special service campaigns, customer support programs, warranty enhancements. What I'm going to recommend everyone do, go, if you have whatever vehicle you have, go to the manufacturer's website, have your VIN number from your vehicle ready, register yourself so that if there are factory-supported programs, unlike the TSBs, that your name's on the list, you're going to get a notification. You're going to know that there's something out there. Now, that's not going to notify you about TSBs, about the routine bulletins. That's a symptom-based thing. You know, if you have a given symptom, you could research on that or take it to a dealer and inquire and have them check it out. But, there's been an explosion of those kind of programs, and it's very difficult to navigate and figure out what might be on your vehicle. So the best thing is to register with the manufacturer and start inquiring like you have when you have a given symptom to see if there's a known fix out there for it.
Okay, well, Aaron, that's a lot of really good advice. Is that a difficult thing to do, Jim? Is that registration, is it pretty simple?
It's usually very simple. The VIN number is typically a 17-digit number on your door jamb or on your windshield. It's obviously the easiest place to find it on your insurance card. Have that with you when you go to the manufacturer's site. They're going to want that number and your contact information so that they can reach out to you when they have a program to offer.
Well, that's an awesome idea. I think I'm going to do that after we're done. We've been talking with Jim Ward. He is the service manager at Smart Motors. Jim has over 10 years of master certification and has worked professionally with vehicles since 1978. We're going to talk to him about car shows after the news. Stay with us. Good afternoon. I'm Jill Najoe, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward is back with us. He's the service manager at Smart Motors, and he has over 10 years of master certification. He has worked professionally with vehicles since 1978, and he's here to answer your vehicle maintenance questions. Has your car been acting funny? Do you have a story about a special car in your life? We'd like to hear that too. So give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and you can post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Now, Jim, it's spring and it's kind of car show season starting up, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Now, they've kind of changed a little bit, sir, in the last 15 years or so.
Oh, they have. They have. Mm-hmm. Car show attendance in Wisconsin had dropped quite a bit. If you go back about 18 years ago, it seemed like it was kind of falling off, and it's picked back up. And, you know, that's attributable to a few different things. I mean, with any given hobby, like cars are a hobby, music is a hobby, there's a point at which the next generation picks it up and they come out with their own thing and you see which way they're going to go with it. And there's been a big resurgence of that. And one of the aspects of that, and we were talking a little bit earlier about things like rat rods.
Right,
I mean, you know what
right.
that is, you don't, but the rat rod is using the body of these cool 40s, 50s, even 60s cars sometimes and putting on a more specialized frame, probably with air suspension and a more modern drive system, but they look awesome, and the influences on them are a little bit different. I'd say women and families have always, you know, been involved in cars, just like they have in football, but as football was marketed different, it kind of changed the experience, I think, for the better. And my experience with car shows the last few years is that there's a lot more whole family involvement, and you see it in the influence of how the car turns out, how the interiors look, you know, and the whole thing. And car shows in general, just because of a younger generation coming out, the whole family going, there's entertainment, there's music, it used to be that you have a, you know, the what was offered for food might be the burger bun, you know, burger hot dog kind of
right.
thing, where now there's a much greater variety of everything. They'll have all kinds of interesting raffles and exhibitions besides the cars. The cars themselves are, you know, just great to look at.
And the cars are so creative these days. It's not what you're expecting, especially those rat rods.
Right, right. I mean, don't get me wrong. The traditional is still there. And in almost any small town in Wisconsin, sometime during the summer, they'll probably have 25 to 50 cars that are the classic same thing. But Automotion and the Dells has got a little bit of something for everybody. I mean, some of the other elements, like drifting is a hobby of cars that, you know, and they set up cars in special ways to do that. So there's a lot of different elements to a car show anymore from just the appearance. And I mean, there are still concours car shows or where they judge a car based on what it was originally supposed to be and how absolutely perfect to that it still is. And you know, that again is interesting, but to me, an old car that's still in primer and hasn't been completely restored and has a few good stories is the most interesting thing out there. I absolutely love those, and everybody's got stories about cars, you know, whether they're a car person or not. Those stories might not be about gear ratios and horsepower numbers, but just about the human experience of the automobile, which, you know, we're all dependent on and have our own experiences with. So
absolutely, they're fun. And you gave me a nice list of websites to go to that have listings of different car shows around. So I'll put that up on our Facebook page later on.
It's a little tricky there really isn't just one good listing for where all the car shows are at. I would say from now until snow flies again, there is probably a car show every week somewhere in Wisconsin. There are a lot of places that just have their weekly, they call it Cars and Coffee,
right.
You know, and those are great too. You know, if there's people and there are cars there's going to be interesting things to see and talk about and experience.
Okay, so, you know, at Facebook, why don't you put down your favorite car show and maybe put a link down so we can all take a look at that, too. We have all the lines filled, so let's go back there. First up is Judy in Green Bay. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a 2010 Honda Fit, and for several years now, frequently, but not all the time, when I turn on the air conditioning or the defrost, I'll get a very foul odor.
Mm.
When it first happened, I took it back to the dealer, and they said, oh, it's about time to change that cabin filter. So we changed the cabin filter, and, you know, again, it didn't do it when I drove out of the dealership, but within several days, it did it again. I guess I have two questions. Number one, can you suggest something I can do to correct it? And number two, how harmful is it if I just let it go?
It's really
pretty bad, but it doesn't happen all the time.
Sure. Judy, this is not an uncommon problem, and it's kind of a new issue. It's manufacturers consider it to be an environmental thing, that there is more mold and spores and stuff in the environment. So mildew, your air conditioning system, your ventilation system in general, is going to be an environment that has condensation form in it. And that condensation is supposed to run down into a pan that has a drain hose out of it. So one thing that I suspect the dealer did, but I would have a question about, is whether that drain is flowing freely. It's just a rubber hose about the diameter of your finger that sticks out the bottom of the car up somewhere between the front wheel. Usually, and when you're running the air conditioner, you should see if it's warm and humid weather, a significant amount of water running out of that hose. So if water is backing up and it's not able to escape as well, of course, you're going to have mold and mildew problems. But with the environment as it is, there's more particulates in the air than there ever been. Those allow for various mold and types of bacteria to stick to them and create these odors. So this sour milk or gym sock odor is what a lot of people call it from the car's ventilation system is a more and more common problem, even when there is no restriction of that vent. They do make products that are kind of like a Lysol sort of product that can be sprayed into the air intake above where the air is drawn into the ventilation system, and then they're also sprayed, another one sprayed from the bottom up through that drain hose. The air conditioner's device in the dasher is called an evaporator, and it, you know, as you can imagine, as condensation drips off of it, particulates from the air may stick to it, and it's just like a little petri dish, so you start to get stuff forming in there. So cleaning that out can help, and obviously it can be a health concern. You know, if you have various allergies, that's not a good thing. There are lots of things you can do to try to address it. The cabin filter, changing it frequently is a good thing. There are charcoal activated carbon filters that are a little better at taking another layer of odors out. I mean, charcoal activated cabin filters, you could see a skunk ahead on the road and hit the recirculate button, and you're probably never going to smell it. You know, take the recirculate off after you go past the skunk, but they do work. But I there are products out there to help sanitize the inside of that fairly closed and fairly humid ventilation system. And that's probably what's going to need to be done to get it any effect of permanently getting rid of that. You could use a charcoal-activated filter to cover it up, but I'd still be concerned that just because you're not smelling it doesn't mean you're not breathing it. And again, allergies could be a concern there.
Is that something that Judy can do herself?
I wouldn't say you couldn't do it. I mean, you know, you could do just about anything yourself. You could almost do your own appendectomy if you Google it, I think, but I wouldn't always recommend it. It's not a super complicated procedure. You know, if you get the right product, you know, Honda probably has a specific product they sell just for that. And really, it is not one of the more complicated things to do on a vehicle. I don't know that anybody and everybody would be able to do it, but you typically don't need a lot of special tools. It is doable.
Okay, great. Thank you, Judy, for the call. Let's go to Jerry in Ashapan. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Say thank you for what you're doing. Say, I do a lot of brake jobs, but I've got a 99 truck, a GM truck, and they went in to get, like, the brake lines that go from the electronic type, well, it goes from the master cylinder over to this electronic box and then over to the front wheel. And I'm concerned about the rust on those that I wanted to change them. And they discontinued the lines that go from that box in the middle there over to the to one of the wheel cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is it's got a rubber hose on there, and I could put on hard lines, but do you know somewhere where I can buy like a generic hose or something, or have them made up or something? I don't know where to go.
There are places that make them up, and unfortunately, some of the better places that we had typically used to use in Madison here are no longer around. So we are kind of I can't tell you a place off the top of my head. You know, something you might Google, because it's not a making and forming hoses and putting specialized fittings on them is something that is definitely still done. I mean, you know, one of the first things that comes to mind is the old swap meets. But that's one of the reasons when you have older vehicles that you go to car shows, is because associated with the car show is often a swap meet where somebody might just have that old part that the manufacturer discontinued. So, but the quicker way is probably to do a Google search for, I mean, in Madison used to have a company called Eggemans who would do a lot of that kind of work. They do custom, you know, hose and fitting jobs like that. Unfortunately, they're no longer around, and again, I just don't have another, but they're out there. That is not uncommon, a service to find. So,
well, good luck with your search, Jerry. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Mark in Wausau. You have a question that I ask myself all the time. Tell us what that is, Mark. Mark,
hello.
Yes, hi, Mark. What's your question?
I have a 2016 Audi Q5. And the recommendation in the owner's manual is that you use 91 octane gasoline. I use 91 or I use 89, and the engine seems to run the same. I don't hear any ping noises. So I want to know, what are the ramifications of using a lower octane than is recommended?
Well, performance is you know, ultimately at the top end of performance, it's going to be affected a little bit by that. Hopefully normally on our daily commutes, we're not experiencing that top end of performance in a vehicle like that. The fuel and ignition system in that vehicle advanced enough to be able to compensate for the difference in octane. You know, I would be more concerned probably with that vehicle about using what are called top tier fuels than I would about whether you use 91 or 89. I mean, generally, I'm going to recommend the most to everyone out there that you use what your manufacturer recommends. It's not a good idea to start playing with different things. I don't think you're doing any harm to that vehicle specifically, again, because the fuel system is intelligent enough to try to compensate for that. But that being said, there are differences in additives that are put in fuel. And when it comes to gasoline that you buy, assuming that you're buying the right gas, the right octane for your vehicle, and not putting a diesel or an E85 in a vehicle that isn't a flex fuel or a diesel vehicle, one of the biggest differences in gas is what they have for additives. There are detergents that are put in gas that are designed to clean deposits off the valves and stuff after your engine's shut off, and those things cool down and kind of dry out on there. And a lot of manufacturers have determined that fuels don't have enough detergents in them to do that properly, and have teamed up with fuel suppliers who identify their fuels as top tier. Those words literally, you'll see it at certain stations. And with that car, I'd be more concerned about using that kind of fuel than those two octane ranges. But again, I will stick with the recommendation that you should use what the manufacturer says.
Stick with the recommendations. Okay. Thanks for the call, Mark. Let's go to Bill in Viroqua. Hi, Bill.
Good afternoon. Thanks for doing this. I've got a 2011 Subaru Outback, and I took it to the dealer for it was overheating and potential head gasket repair. The car had 100,000 miles on it. So they did the head gasket repair and did the timing belt while they were in there and the water pump. We paid our bill and came home with it, and 75 miles later, the car overheated, and it overheated so loud. My shop is about 70 yards from the garage that it was parked, and I heard it cracking and groaning. Hmm. So they came and got the car, and now they're trying to tell me that there's probably no other damage done internally to that engine. What would your guess be as to any more damage done on the lower end?
Well, that's a crystal ball question. It obviously, if there's immediate damage, it's going to have a bearing knock and noise. But that doesn't mean that just because there isn't that noise, that there hasn't been some degree of compromise and how long things may last. It's difficult to know how hot it got. But it probably did set a code, and in some, I'm not sure with Subaru, but I believe they do have a freeze frame that would occur when it got to a certain temperature that would tell what temperature it was at. And I guess I would be inquiring to the dealer what they found there, what that code was, and what the temperature. That alone still won't tell us. There still isn't a crystal ball to say what damage was done. It depends on how long it ran that hot. One of the things that tend to happen more than bearing damage is just actual head warpage and damage to some of the upper end components on the engine. So what did they actually have to do this second time around? What repair did they do?
They said there was a bubble in the antifreeze system, apparently. Looked under the hood, there was no fluid in the reservoir tank.
Yeah, and that is there are airless ways to bleed, to change the fluid or add fluid to a cooling system, because that is always a concern. You get an air bubble in to the technician, it looks full. At about 10 miles later, that air bubble burps out and the level drops quite a bit. So that certainly can happen. But they're basically saying that they filled it up with fluid, now everything's fine and there was no damage.
Right, and well, it smelled just terrible in the garage. It had just such an odor that... we won't describe it on the air.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested in some numbers from them if I were you, like a compression test to see that the engine still has good compression, to know what that number was and how hot it actually got, if that was recorded, and it probably was when an engine gets that hot. I can tell you it's certainly plausible that no immediate damage was done. There are lots of things that can occur to a car that may compromise and marginalize how long the engine's actually going to last in some respect, but it's not really easily measurable. And they may be right. There may not be any damage, but I certainly understand your concern. At that mileage, I don't know what the likelihood that they would be able to take out a powertrain service contract for you, but that's the other thing I think I would start negotiating with them about, is to see if they could possibly provide you with a powertrain road hazard coverage that would cover the internal engine parts for a period of time going forward, to just give you some additional reassurance that if something goes wrong here, that you've got some recourse and some coverage.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call, Bill. Jacob in Milwaukee contacted us, and he said he has a manual VW and wants to teach his 17-year-old son to drive stick. Now, the car is nearing 100K and will probably need a new clutch sometime soon. Should he teach him now and replace the clutch after he learns to drive, or replace it first? And how much damage can he do to the car learning to drive?
Oh, yeah.
That's a great question.
I've got two boys who are adults now, and I tell you what, I never looked forward to anything in life as much as I did to teaching them to drive. And after our first couple of experiences, my wife did a really good job teaching them to drive. They can absolutely wreck the car.
Oh,
that
yes.
doesn't mean they will. I mean, you know, he might be a great driver. He might, you know, some people just have the ability to have a feel for the machine. And it doesn't matter whether you're a guy or a girl. Some people just have this great feel for a machine. Most of us don't. Most of us are going to bump into a couple things, are going to burn that clutch out. I'm definitely going to recommend it. I don't know how bad the clutch is right now. I mean, if you can put it in fifth gear and let the clutch out and it doesn't stall, it keeps running, then the clutch is really gone, and it's going to be difficult for him to learn to drive a clutch well in it. But if the clutch has got pretty good life yet and you put it in fifth gear and let the clutch out and it stalls, then you want to have the brake on real firm when you do that, by the way, then the clutch has probably got pretty good life, and his learning to drive it is certainly probably going to go through the clutch on it. You know, it's admirable to teach him to drive a stick. You know, I see fewer and fewer manual transmissions and fewer people that know how to drive them, and everybody really should. You never know in an emergency when you might need to get into something like that and drive it. So definitely want to teach him that, but I would plan on doing the clutch afterwards take some big breaths. It takes a lot of patience to teach someone to drive.
It does. And sometimes the close relatives are probably the worst ones to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good luck, Jacob. Excuse me. Let's go to Patrick. He's calling from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Patrick.
Hi there. Good afternoon.
What can we help you with?
I have a 2007 Ford Ranger that any time I accelerate, my air conditioning shuts out.
That could be inconvenient in the summer.
Your blower motor continues to work, and that's right. The vent blower continues to blow air.
Nope.
Or it doesn't.
It stops.
It completely turns off, too. Well, the air conditioner in any given vehicle is designed to work only if the blower is working. If the blower isn't turned on, you can have your air conditioner on, but if you don't have the blower turned on, then the circuits won't allow the air conditioner to come on. So the question is, why is the blower motor quitting? That is very possibly just a connection problem. The blower motor is a circuit. The blower circuit has got a set of resistors in it that are what give you the various speeds. And ultimately, I'm going to bet here that somewhere in the connections between the resistors and the blower motor, or the resistors and the fuse junction block that they are powered by, that there is a circuit that is getting tugged on when you accelerate, or maybe a bad ground somewhere in there. And if it's taking power from the blower motor, then the air conditioner isn't going to function.
Okay. Well, good luck finding the answer to that one, Patrick. Let's go to Dick in Viroqua. Hi, Dick.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a 2014 CR-V Honda. And I've had it since I bought it when it had 5,000 miles on it. And whenever it's wet out and I back out of the garage, the brakes squeal. Well, after I go down the road, you know, three or four blocks, touch the brakes a couple times, they stop squealing.
Sure. Dick, and I can tell you that's a common experience a lot of people have. When it's humid out, brakes are prone to squeak. A lot of manufacturers will call that normal. There are products you can put on your brake that you can soak them with, but that to help reduce noise. But that's temporary. I will tell you that driving style has something to do with it. The brake rotor, the disc that your brake pads are rubbing against, can get flash oxidation overnight during humid conditions, and that contributes to the sound as well. I don't recommend braking this way, but we all see people who haul it to a stop all at the last minute. And people that brake that way create a lot of friction. And in the real world of the physics involved here, they have less brake noise because they leave less oxidation on their brake pads and on the brake rotors. So I'm not going to recommend that you start hauling to a stop at the last minute, but I think you're going to find that if you occasionally take that car out on, obviously be careful what's behind you, but a highway speed, hit the brake really hard, you don't want to lock up the wheels, you're going to create some friction that will reduce the brake noise that you hear for quite a while afterward. There's a lot of different compound makeups and brake pads that can affect how much noise they make, and that can be a factor too. There's a lot of variables involved here, but it's not necessarily abnormal in humid and wet conditions to have brakes squeal.
Okay. Well, good luck with you, Dick. Thanks for the call. And Jim, thank you so much again for
Absolutely.
Being here.
It was great.
You do such a great job. We've been talking with Jim Ward. He's the service manager at Smart Motors, and Jim has over 10 years of master certification. He's going to be back with us on June 20th. Thanks to Cheryl Gasser for on-air production and to Dave Potraz for technical direction. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we're going to take a look at native plants in the Midwest with the author of A New Comprehensive Guide. Hope you can join us at 11. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us. There's more to come.